From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The major question right now is, are we going to hear everything today when the indictments are announced? And what I'm hearing is that we won't. A big part of this story remains to be played out.
As the country waits to see whether indictments will be handed down to top White House officials in the CIA leak case, we'll take a look at the latest with law professor Scott Horton and journalist Laura Rosen. Then, as the number of U.S. soldiers killed in Iraq tops 2,000, we take an in-depth look at what it means to be a soldier deployed in Iraq with the latest episode of the documentary series Off to War, from rural Arkansas to Baghdad.
I mean, they've tried killing me, you know, my guys, my friends. You know, we've all been affected by these knuckleheads, and I'm sick of them. You know, the only way they're going to stop is to kill them. And all I need to do is just give me half an opportunity, and I'll do it.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Harriet Myers has withdrawn her nomination to be a Supreme Court justice. Earlier today, President Bush announced he'd accepted her decision. Myers has come under intense criticism from the Christian right and many Republican senators. In a letter dated today, Myers said she was concerned that the confirmation process, quote, would create a burden for the White House and our staff that is not in the best interest of the country. Myers went on to write she needed to withdraw because senators were seeking White House records that could not be released because of executive privilege. Conservative columnist Charles Krauthammer had written last week that this would be the honorable way for Myers to withdraw. He ended his column by saying, quote, "Face is saved and we start again." In a statement today, Bush said he, quote, reluctantly accepted her decision to withdraw. The two have been close friends for nearly 20 years. Myers began working for Bush when he was running for governor of Texas in 1994. She remains White House counsel. Myers would have become the third woman to have served on the Supreme Court. Rumors continue to fly in Washington over whether any top White House officials will be forced to resign this week for their involvement in the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. On Wednesday, Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald presented a summary of his case to the grand jury, which could hand down indictments today or tomorrow. According to the Washington Post, Karl Rove's legal team has been engaged in a furious effort to convince Fitzgerald that Rove did not commit perjury. If indicted, Rove will most likely be forced to step down. We'll have more on this in a few minutes. The Village Voice is reporting over 1,500 events took place across the country on Wednesday to commemorate the death of the 2,000th U.S. soldier in Iraq. In Washington, anti-war activist Cindy Sheehan and 25 others were arrested for demonstrating without a permit in front of the White House. The protesters lay on the ground in a die-in to symbolize the U.S. soldiers killed. In New York, several hundred flooded the Armed Forces recruiting station in Times Square with shouts of, "Bush lied, 2,000 died." In Israel, a suicide bombing at an open-air market in the town of Hadera killed 5 Israelis and wounded over 30 others Wednesday. Palestinian militant group Islamic Jihad claimed responsibility, calling the attack a retaliation for Israel's killing of Louis Saadi, a leader of the group's military wing, Monday. Following the bombing, Israel launched airstrikes on Gaza Strip. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz is reporting the Israeli government has approved a major military operation into Palestinian areas. In the West Bank, the Israeli army planned to impose a curfew, close off all border crossings, and bar all travel within the territory's northern area. In northern Gaza, Israeli tanks will enter near Beit Hanun. Ground forces will be deployed for a possible large-scale operation. Meanwhile, newly elected Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad drew international condemnation Wednesday for saying on state television, quote, "Israel must be wiped off the map." In response to Ahmadinejad, Israeli Vice Premier Shimon Peres said Iran should be expelled from the U.S. Lawyers for hunger-striking prisoners at Guantanamo Bay won a federal court order Wednesday mandating the government provide them with clients' medical records and to notify them before their clients are subjected to involuntary force feedings. As Democracy Now! Reported last week, scores of hunger-striking detainees have been force-fed with tubes up their noses at the U.S. military prison. The independent inquiry investigating the United Nations Oil for Food program in Iraq will release a report today that says over 2,000 companies paid illegal kickbacks to Saddam Hussein's regime. This according to the New York Times. The Oil for Food program was in place from 1996 to 2003 and allowed the Iraqi government to sell oil in exchange for humanitarian goods. The inquiry, headed by former Federal Reserve Chair Paul Volcker, says Hussein made $1.8 billion from Oil for Food surcharges and kickbacks. That number's dwarfed by the almost $11 billion the report says Hussein made from oil smuggling to U.S. allies, Jordan and Turkey, all with the full knowledge of the U.S. government. The Washington Post is reporting the House bill that would renew the USA Patriot Act includes little-notice provisions that would dramatically alter the federal death penalty. The bill allows for smaller juries to decide on executions and grant prosecutors the right to retry suspects if a jury deadlocks on sentencing. The bill also triples the number of terrorism-related crimes eligible for the death penalty. The Justice Department has already endorsed the provisions. Jennifer Daskal of Human Rights Watch told the Post, quote, "These are radical changes in the way federal death penalty cases are litigated, and they were added virtually without any debate." U.S. energy companies are reporting record quarterly earnings this week. ExxonMobil is expected to report a third-quarter profit of $8.6 billion. The Los Angeles Times notes the figure amounts to more than what Coca-Cola, Intel, and Time Warner earn in an entire year. Third-quarter profits at ConocoPhillips, the country's third-largest oil company, are up 89%. Together, the 29 major oil and gas firms are expected to earn $96 billion this year, up from $68 billion last year. And this news from the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. The Bush administration has agreed to reinstate a workers' rights law it had waived for the reconstruction effort in the Gulf Coast. The waiver of the Davis-Bacon Act allowed federal contractors to pay workers less than the area's prevailing wage. The move drew widespread criticism from Democrats and labor groups. Prevailing wages in the region were already among the lowest in the country. In media news, CBS has replaced its news chief with its top sports broadcasting executive. CBS sports head Sean McManus will replace Andrew Hayward, who headed CBS News since 1996. The New York Times notes McManus has no formal news experience. A CBS spokesperson confirmed reports on political blogs that McManus had made a $250 contribution to the Bush-Cheney campaign in 2004. He's also made political contributions to Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy. In a visit to South Africa, civil rights leader Jesse Jackson lent support to exiled Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Aristide has been living in exile in South Africa since being ousted in a coup, February 2004. Reverend Jackson said, quote, "The people did not remove him. The U.S. government removed him."
This is the boys as they stand in line. The smell of gun grease and their bayonets they shine. He's there to help them all that he can. To make them feel wanted, he's a good holy man.
Cry. Sky!
it ends with a smile. The order is given, they move down the line. But he's still behind, and he'll meditate. But it won't stop the bleeding or ease the hate. And the young men move out into the battle zone.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers. Rumors continue to fly in Washington over whether any top White House officials will be forced to resign for their involvement in the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. On Wednesday, Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald presented a summary of his case to the grand jury, which could hand down indictments today or tomorrow. According to the Washington Post, Karl Rove's legal team has been engaged in a furious effort to convince Fitzgerald that Rove did not commit perjury. The D.C.-based newspaper Roll Call reported that Fitzgerald was spotted Wednesday at the offices of Rove's attorney.
Meanwhile, on Tuesday, a member of Fitzgerald's team interviewed former White House press aide Adam Levine about conversations he had with Rove on July 11, 2003. Just days before Plame's name first appeared in the press. The grand jury is set to expire Friday, but there's been speculation Fitzgerald might try to extend the grand jury's term. On Wednesday, White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan was questioned about the impact the investigation has had on the White House.
Well, first of all, and there's a lot of speculation going around, and I think there are a lot of facts that simply are not known at this point. It remains an ongoing investigation, and we'll let the special prosecutor continue to do his work, and I'm sure he will have more to say in due course. In terms of the White House, this White House is focused on the priorities of the American people. We're working on the priorities that the American people care about. The president has had a very busy day. He started his morning focused on the highest priorities facing this country, which is winning the war on terrorism and protecting the homeland.
That was White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan speaking Wednesday to discuss the latest news about the CIA leak investigation and to explain how grand jury indictments work. We're joined by two guests. Laura Rosen is a Washington, D.C.-based journalist, senior correspondent for the American Prospect, frequently writes about national security and foreign policy issues on her blog, warandpeace.com. And we're joined in our New York studio by Scott Horton, chair of the International Law Committee at the New York City Bar Association. He's also adjunct professor of law at Columbia University, where he lectures on international law and international humanitarian law. Laura Rosen, let's begin with you. Can you tell us the latest at the point of this broadcast?
I'm afraid I can't. I was really preparing to speak more on these Niger forgeries, and I'm
go ahead.
Up on the latest from overnight, really on the leak investigation. I apologize.
No, that's fine. Why don't you talk about exactly what you're referring to when you talk about how Niger fits into this story?
You know, the outing of Valerie Plame is kind of the end of this long process that began with these documents, these forged documents that came into the possession of the U.S. government that purported to show a contract for Iraq to purchase vast quantities of yellow cake uranium in the African country of Niger. So in Italy this week, an investigative reporting team has made great headway in actually identifying who were the people who actually set this whole forgeries in motion that, you know, the Bush administration cited as one of the reasons they thought that Iraq was reconstituting its nuclear weapons. And it turns out to be various current and ex-officials from the Italian military intelligence organization, SISMI. And that's quite interesting because, you know, the Italian prime minister was very supportive, was a supporter of President Bush and was one of the few European allies to support the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And they kept through various channels trying to channel this false intelligence to the U.S. and British intelligence.
Now, many Americans here are not familiar with this angle, this Italian angle to the entire situation here of the false information given out about the about Niger and nuclear weapons. Could you talk about a little bit about the La Repubblica articles and exactly what is the connection between officials in the Bush administration and this Italian the forgeries that originated there.
Right. Well, Vice President Cheney asked his CIA briefers in February 2002 that says that he'd heard something about this Niger yellow clay claim and asked them to find out more. They sent Joseph Wilson on the trip to Niger. He didn't. Cheney's office apparently didn't know anything about this. It's 7-8 months later, September 2002, just as Andy Card is saying, you know, now's the time for the White House to make its sales pitch to the country for the war. And, you know, Vice President Cheney is going on TV saying, talking about Iraq reconstituting its nuclear weapons. Now we find out that the head of Italian military intelligence came to meet with a White House official, which is very unusual. And he met with Steve Hadley, who has also been someone who's been identified as part of a kind of alleged conspiracy in the White House to eventually out Joseph Wilson's wife to the media as a CIA operative, kind of as retaliation for Joseph Wilson pushing back on these false Niger uranium claims. Does that tie the two things together? Does that make clear how the leak investigation is tied in some ways to these documents?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. But also in terms of Hadley's then role in the Bush administration putting out this information.
It's not clear. He was Deputy National Security Advisor at the time. He's National Security Advisor now. He met with the head of Italian military intelligence September 9, 2002. The NSC spokesman told me, you know, that meeting's not necessarily secret. It's just that Hadley's schedule's not public. On the Italian side, my colleagues at La Repubblica tell me that the head of Italian military intelligence doesn't admit to having met with Hadley.
And so you have Hadley goes to Italy.
No, Polori comes here.
He comes here. They have the meeting. And explain again how this information then got out in the Italian publication and the connection of that Italian publication to Berlusconi.
So then a month after Hadley and the head of Italian military intelligence meet, in September 2002, a reporter for an Italian magazine owned by the Italian Prime Minister, Silvio Berlusconi, gets passed by a shady middleman in Italy a bunch of documents that turn out to be the Niger forgeries. And her editor, who's kind of a favorite in the Berlusconi media empire, tells her, take these immediately to the U.S. Embassy in Rome, which she does, and they get cabled back to Washington. So even though the CIA originally dismissed these whole Niger uranium claims at several points, as had the State Department, as being unsubstantiated, and Joe Wilson went on his trip to Niger and also found these claims to be unsubstantiated, you find the president, you know, in January 2003 citing Iraq's alleged efforts to acquire uranium in Niger as being one of his, you know, in his State of the Union address.
So, Scott Horton, you have the story of top Bush administration official meeting with Italian intelligence and then soon a publication owned by the Prime Minister of Italy, Berlusconi, who is a close Bush ally, publishes this information that Saddam Hussein is getting 500 tons of yellow cake uranium from Niger. The significance of this?
Well, it's actually a bombshell. Because it shows this entire investigation doubling back and coming to the very beginning, to the original case of the yellow cake forgeries. People have been asking for a long time, why is it that people in the vice president's staff were so concerned about Ambassador Wilson and his debunking of the yellow cake forgeries? I mean, many people have thought it just doesn't make sense that they would be so deeply engaged. Of course, one thing we know from the investigation, what's come out from it to date, is that they were very deeply involved from the top of the staff to the bottom of it. And this shows the first glimmers of a real explanation for that by linking key figures from the White House and what Colonel Wilkerson has is called the cabal around Vice President Cheney to the forgeries
Wilkerson
themselves.
Being the former chief of staff of Powell.
Exactly right. I mean, there's no evidence that's come out that suggests that these people uttered the forgeries, but it does suggest that they had a great interest in them. They knew about them from a very early date, and they knew there were forgeries from very early on, and nevertheless showed great interest in getting these documents out and into the public. And there was a very, very high-level complicity between White House figures and Prime Minister Berlusconi and senior confidants of his.
I want to go to break, and then we're going to come back. Laura Rosen, thanks very much for being with us, and your website, your blog, warandpeace.com, writing for the American Prospect. Scott Horton, I'd like you to stay on to talk also about Vice President Dick Cheney. The Washington Post editorial yesterday saying Vice President for Torture, Maureen Dowd saying just say Vice. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute.
Things you want are real.
You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
Stand, Sly and the Family Stone here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest is Scott Horton, who is a law professor here in New York City. Scott Horton, the issue of this grand jury, what it has been impaneled for how long, who are they, and what happens now?
Well, we have 23 citizens from the District of Columbia who are serving, and they've been in session now for a very long time, I think more than a year.
Full-time?
No, it's not full-time. They meet several times in the course of a month. I think this grand jury has been meeting pretty regularly on Fridays in the afternoon, but it's a tremendous amount of service that they're providing. And Friday is the last day of their scheduled term. Or is it? That's one of the questions we've got, because what happened yesterday that has attracted a lot of interest from lawyers is that the special prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald, had a 30 to 45 minute meeting with Chief Judge Hogan. Now, why would he have had that meeting? It could have been a courtesy call. That's not terribly likely. More likely, he was either seeking to arrange special meeting times for the current grand jury, seeking to extend its term, or seeking to have indictments that have been voted or are about to be voted put under seal. And that suggests very strongly that the investigation is, in fact, not completely wrapped up now. We may have charges announced today, but that there's an important slice of it remaining to be completed.
From the perspective of the Bush administration, would it be better for this grand jury to be extended or for this to drag out, or would it be better for them to have it, if these indictments are going to come down, have them come down now and begin the process of adjustment into the new conditions?
Well, I think surely they would like to get this behind them. And having an open portion of it is going to create an ongoing public distraction. I think, you know, most commentators looking at the White House in the last month see it as nearly incapacitated by this scandal. You already referred earlier in the broadcast to withdrawals and reversals. The Myers nomination is floundering. This is a political low point for the White House, no doubt about it.
So could you have some indictments handed down today, others announced later?
Absolutely. And we could have a number of indictments handed down today that won't be announced.
Sealed.
They'll be under
seal. For what reason?
Well, there are a number of reasons why you would put it's a rather unusual process putting indictments under seal. We should state that up front. The most traditional cause for it is to not let slip the fact that someone's going to be indicted so they can be apprehended. You're afraid that they're going to flee. That doesn't make sense when we're dealing with public officials, frankly. What would make sense with public officials is that the fact of the indictment would tip people to the fact that they and people who are working with them are targets of the investigation. And I think, obviously, of all the things we've seen, the Italian side of this is the most intriguing. I think it's most likely that that part of the investigation hasn't been finished. But this is just speculation.
Can a vice president be indicted?
Well, vice presidents have been indicted. In fact, Aaron Burr was indicted twice, and Spiro Agnew was indicted. But there is a question of executive immunity, and how far does executive immunity go? And on that issue, actually, the leading authority is probably Robert Bork, a former judge and Yale law professor, who wrote quite in great detail about this, saying that the vice president does not have immunity, that that's really limited to the president. But that's not really a settled question.
But how would it be possible to have sealed indictments with the actual people indicted be notified, or even they would not know that they've been indicted?
They would not be notified of the fact that they'd be indicted, and neither would the public.
We're talking to Scott Horton, who is the chair of International Law Committee at the New York City Bar Association, also adjunct professor of law at Columbia University. I wanted to ask you about the issue of torture. The Bush administration is coming under increased criticism for attempting to justify the torture of detainees. According to the New York Times, Vice President Dick Cheney, CIA Director Porter Goss, met with Senator John McCain last week to urge him to exempt CIA officers from a proposed ban on torture. 3 weeks ago, the Senate voted 90-9 to ban the use of cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment of any detainee held by the government.
Vice President Dick Cheney reportedly said the CIA needed to be exempt because the president needs maximum flexibility in fighting the so-called war on terrorism. On Wednesday, Human Rights Watch declared that the U.S. has now become, quote, the only government in the world to claim a legal justification for mistreating prisoners during interrogations.
And the Washington Post yesterday, an editorial, basically said vice president for torture, saying that the vice president is the first top government official to openly advocate for torture. Scott Horton.
Well, I thought that was a very well-taken editorial, and it's interesting that this debate comes back to Vice President Cheney because, in fact, from all we've seen so far, people focus on Defense Secretary Rumsfeld as the source of torture policy within the administration. That's not really correct. I mean, this began as an initiative of Vice President Cheney's, and we know going back to 2002, early in the year, he was making the round of talk shows and talking about the need to use the dark arts. He was clearly advocating torture, and he was advocating it within the CIA and later the Defense Department. Now he's come back and said we have to give the president authority to authorize the use of these highly coercive techniques by the CIA. He's saying, all right, the uniformed military will exclude from this. But of course, that was the principal issue that was debated in the Senate when Senator McCain put forward his amendment and was quite decisively rejected. I mean, there are 91 senators who opposed it. We only had 90 votes recorded because John Corzine, of course, was campaigning for governor in New Jersey and couldn't have his vote recorded. But it was an overwhelming victory. So it shows just an amazing degree of stubbornness on the part of Cheney that he's continuing to push this. And also the fact that in the midst of this crisis in which he really sits in the center, that he is devoting so much of his time to the torture issue demonstrates how deeply involved Vice President Cheney is in that issue.
You know, we've had so many stories coming out from beginning with Abu Ghraib and the Guantanamo situation and the mistreatment of prisoners in Afghanistan and other detention facilities. Do you feel that because these stories have come out now in drips and drabs over about a couple of years now, that the American public is sort of like tuned out to the enormous scandal that is occurring in terms of how our military is treating prisoners in this war on terrorism?
Well, actually, if you look at public opinion polling, you'll see that there was a surprisingly high level of acceptance for torture shortly after 9/11, and the situation has reversed. I mean, what we're seeing right now is a very broad public rejection of torture and rejection of torture under all circumstances. It may be that the voice of moral indignation is a bit lacking. But conceptually, it's definitely being rejected. And I would say, in connection with the McCain Amendment, the really decisive turn here was the fact that a large number of senior retired military officers, led by Colin Powell and General Shelly Kashvili, both former chairmen of the Joint Chief of Staff, but I think altogether about 40 flag officers, came forward and began to aggressively advocate this and supported Senator McCain and Senator Graham in the trenches with this measure.
Why would Scott Horton, Vice President Cheney, who his whole office is under fierce scrutiny right now, aggressively pursue this, to say the least, extremely controversial, the Washington Post says, unprecedented for an elected official of the executive branch to propose that Congress legally authorize human rights abuses by Americans? Why now?
Well, the charitable explanation would be to say that he really believes coercive techniques are necessary for security. I'm not inclined to be charitable on this issue. I think there's another reason. The reason is that if this matter were thoroughly investigated, if a commission of inquiry were created and that measure is pending, that commission is going to show that Vice President Cheney is the man who unleashed torture and promoted it within our military and our intelligence service.
Why doesn't it go higher to Bush? Why do you stop at Cheney?
We don't really see any engagement by President Bush in the issue, and I think there of course a number of people have looked very closely for it, which is not to say that President Bush doesn't share blame. He made the decision, he issued presidential findings and orders, and he supported it. And President Bush has continued this mantra, I think repeated by Scott McClellan as recently as 2 days ago: we do not torture, we do not do that, we treat people humanely. Well, in fact, even people around President Bush recognized that that's just not true.
Scott Horton, yesterday we interviewed General, well now Colonel Janis Karpinski, the commanding general at Abu Ghraib, the only general to be demoted in the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. What about that? The fact that, well, where is everyone else in this story? Where is General Miller? Where is General Sanchez? What's happened to these people? And well, will they eventually be held responsible?
That's a good question. In fact, every time the Senate Armed Services Committee meets, you hear Senator Warner, Senator McCain, Senator Graham, and all the Democrats asking that very same question. And this affair is not going to be resolved until there is accountability established at the command level. And Brigadier General Karpinski, I won't use her demoted rank, clearly bears responsibility, but so do others high up the chain of command, including the vice president and certainly including Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld. And this is something that has to be really thoroughly investigated and acted upon. And in the end of the day, it'll have to be acted upon through prosecutions.
And if those prosecutions were to occur, do you think that they'd have to be initiated by some other U.S. attorney? I mean, it would be the possibility of Fitzgerald even extending his investigation so broadly, and even into cover-ups or of the torture situation by the government. Who else would initiate those prosecutions?
Well, I think this is a very important question. In fact, it's something I've discussed with senior military people regularly. They're concerned. They don't want the International Criminal Court. They don't want foreign prosecutions. And they really see the cost of avoiding that sort of international accountability is being sure that we do the job ourselves at home. And, of course, it can't be done by this Justice Department or by Attorney General Gonzalez. He's too deeply wound up in this himself. itself. In fact, note the Justice Department is not prosecuting the homicides that are connected to the CIA. As soon as it did that, such a prosecution, the question of the Justice Department's own torture memoranda would come forward. So what you need is someone like Patrick Fitzgerald, frankly. You need a special prosecutor who's appointed to develop a case and bring charges.
And how finally do you answer, Scott Horton, those who are talking about, I just heard Richard Clark, for example, yesterday, the former counterterrorism czar, saying we've got to stop criminalizing politics.
Well, I agree with that, but I'd also say, that there's a trivial sort of criminalization. But here we're talking about not what's going on in Washington, D.C. We're talking about what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places around the world. And we're talking about murder, homicide, serious assault, torture. These are the most serious sorts of crimes that exist. And the United States took a very aggressive posture about this sort of criminality at the end of the Second World War. We repeated that again during the Yugoslav campaign and following the genocide in Rwanda, taking a principal position that there must be prosecutions, including of political figures. It cannot be the case from the U.S. perspective that this is true for sub-equatorial African dictatorships and for the Yugoslav regime, for the Germans and the Japanese, but not for the United States. That's not possible.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Scott Horton is the head of the International Human Rights Committee of the New York City Bar Association, adjunct professor at Columbia University, law professor. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 380 radio and TV stations around the country, low-power FM stations, Pacifica stations, NPR stations, college radio stations, as well as public access TV, PBS stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, as well as DirecTV, Channel 375. And we are podcasting at democracynow.org as we move on to our next story, Juan.
Well, this week, two major news stories dominating the headlines have converged. The CIA leak case in Washington and the grim milestone of 2,000 U.S. soldiers killed in Iraq. And they're linked. The CIA leak case is about smearing a whistleblower who challenged the Bush administration's pretext for the Iraq invasion, weapons of mass destruction. Well, we all know there were no weapons, WMDs now, but there is still a war. And as protests, vigils, and rallies are held around the country to mark the 2,000th American soldier killed, 159,000 troops are still deployed in Iraq, matching the largest American force ever in that country. Today, we go off to war.
War! Let it be.
Good God, John!
What is he good for?
Absolutely nothing.
Yes, that wasn't an a cappella group. It was the voices of members of the Arkansas National Guard. They're the subject of a multi-part documentary series airing on Discovery Times called Off to War, From Rural Arkansas to Baghdad. The series was one of the first to deal with the ongoing problem of U.S. troops having inadequate equipment and unarmored vehicles in Iraq. This is an excerpt of Off to War.
The convoy we're getting ready to take to Camp Taji, north of Baghdad, it's pretty serious. Some of the equipment is old, so we're trying to make sure it doesn't break down.
I have no idea why, the United States Army would make us deploy with this old crap. And I think they're going to quickly understand that when half of it breaks down on the way to Taji, and it will, that it's not a good idea to deploy a National Guard unit with old Vietnam-era equipment.
This is what an armored vehicle should look like. The vehicle is totally armored, completely all the way around, even in the front windshields. This is the modern vehicles that the regular Army has right now.
We were promised up armor kits, we didn't get them, and so we're going to go ahead and try to fabricate something.
Hey, sir. You think we could use some of this stuff?
We're trying to use as much of the metal as we can, but we only have a limited supply of it, so, we have to resort to these old bulletproof vests. And honestly, I don't feel too comfortable with doing that, but we've got to use what we can.
The sandbags will act to deflect the blast from a roadside bomb or deflect bullets if it were shot at.
An excerpt of the third installment of the Off to War series. We brought you that clip more than a year ago. Now there have been more than seven episodes produced. Episode 6 will be airing on Saturday on Discovery Times. When we come back from break, we'll be joined by the brother filmmakers, Brent and Craig Renault. Like the Arkansas National Guardsmen who've headed off to war, they too are from Arkansas. In fact, went to high school with some of the guardsmen who are in Iraq. Stay with us.
Mama, mama, forget your pies. Have faith they won't get cold. Then turn your eyes to the bloodshot sky. Your flag is flying full at half-mast for the matadors who turned their backs to please the crowd and all fell before the bull. Red was the color of his blood flowing thin. Pallid white was the color of his lifeless skin. Blue was the color of the morning sky. He saw looking up from the ground where he died. It was the last thing ever seen by him.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're joined by the Renault brothers. That's Craig and Brent Renault, producers of the documentary series Off to War, from rural Arkansas to Baghdad, which is following members of the Arkansas National Guard as they've deployed to Iraq. On Saturday, the sixth installment of the series will air on Discovery Times. It is an absolutely riveting, remarkable series. The clips we've just played before the break, we played before. You were really the first to play nationally this part of the story of the National Guard going to war with these Vietnam-era gear where they weren't protected. You went to school with some of the guys in the Guard, Craig.
That's correct. We Brent and I both grew up in Little Rock, and when we found out about the deployment, it was actually through a best friend of mine. His father was a retired colonel from the National Guard, and that's actually how we got access to begin with. But not only through him, but we also had a lot of friends from grade school and even high school that were going to be soldiers in this deployment.
Yeah, this was a huge deal in Arkansas. It was the largest call-up since the Korean War. 3,000 people from a small rural state. So it was a really big deal. It was on all the local news every single night. Everybody was covering it. So we thought it was something important that we needed to be a part of.
How long have you been doing it?
Oh, it's been 2 years now. They were activated in October 2003, and they arrived in Baghdad in April 2004, right when the Fallujah really kicked off, right when the four contractors were hung from the bridge there. They were going in for a peace and stability mission, and it changed really fast, and it was clear that they were going in for a combat mission, actually.
Now, we've been hearing a lot about soldiers who had second and even third tours in Iraq. Any of this Guard unit now, it's been there obviously more than a year. Now, are you finding now some of the reservists who are doing second and third tours as well?
Well, in terms of the guys that we're following, they're back now. They just got back in April of 2005, so they've been home for a few months. A lot of the guys that we're following are getting out of the National Guard now. The ones who still have 3 to 4 years left on their contract are waiting to see if they'll be deployed again. There's a two-year limit in terms of their deployability for National Guard, and this deployment, they used up 18 months of that 2 years that they're eligible to be deployed. So they have to be back stateside for a certain period of time before they're deployable again. So it doesn't look like anytime soon they'll be redeployed. But, you know, a number of them still have years left on their contract.
It was one of the reasons we really wanted to do this film, because we thought it was an historic moment in the terms of part-time soldiers, National Guardsmen, and reservists. This was really the last time that if you're in there, you don't expect or think you're going somewhere to fight. Pretty much if you join now, you know you're going somewhere, whether it's Afghanistan, whether it's Iraq, or whether it's going to be somewhere else. But this was a moment in time where the families weren't necessarily ready for it and the soldiers didn't know what they were getting into.
You know, it's really interesting you raise that, Brent, because with the hurricane, Katrina, you have the head of the National Guard saying this is the best reason to sign up because you're going to help your fellow countrymen and women in a time of, you know, disaster. And I think that's very compelling for a lot of people. A lot of people want to help. But in fact, that may well not be where they end up.
Yeah, absolutely. And when they got back, some of the guys were actually called down to help at Katrina. And they got back and they actually were quite pleased about this. They said, this is what I signed up for. This is really what I wanted to do. We have a lot of tornadoes in Arkansas, a lot of floods. And this is what they were used to doing before. And all that's changed now.
What's been the reaction in Arkansas to the series? And have you gotten much feedback from the families and neighbors and people in your community?
Yeah, all the soldiers and their families have seen all the episodes that have aired so far, and we've had extremely positive feedback from them. The one thing that was really important for us with making this film is that we didn't have any narration, no music in the film, and it was really important for us to present this from the perspective of the soldiers. And that's something that we did throughout, and I think the families have really appreciated that because they've said unanimously, you know, you told it the way that it happened, you told it through our voice, and I think that's really helped them appreciate the film.
Set up this next clip for us. This is what is going to air Saturday night, Discovery Times, 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. You guys, well, the unit was ambushed.
Yeah, we were on a nighttime patrol. It was last July. It was pretty soon after the handover of power. And the Arkansas National Guard had started working with the Iraqi police on all of their missions. And, you know, from the very beginning, there was a large lack of trust in terms of the Iraqi police force because a lot of the guys just felt, you know, they weren't sure in terms of who they could trust with the guys they were working with. And we came under attack. The vehicles that we were riding in came under attack. It was a full-scale ambush. And after the ambush, it became pretty evident that they were set up by the Iraqi police. And so in the episode 6, you'll see the ambush, and then after that, you see a very lengthy investigation into the Iraqi police.
Let's go to that clip. The Arkansas National Guard ambushed in Iraq. Our guests in the studio are the brother producers who filmed this, Craig and Brent Renault, producers of the documentary series Off to War. Which one of you were there?
I was there that night.
What were your feelings?
Well, I mean, actually, I wasn't very surprised. I mean, we'd been going out on these patrols 2 weeks before that at night, and each night it seemed the activity kept increasing. The night before this, we had a rocket shot over our head, and we're, you know, the soldiers were chasing down, you know, trying to figure out who had shot that rocket. So for those 2 weeks right after the handover, there was really a lead up to this. So I wasn't that surprised once it happened. Of course, once it did happen, you know, you're very scared for your life, but you're also focusing on making sure that you capture all of this as it's happening.
The next clip ties into this about the U.S. troops confronting Iraqi troops, police.
That's correct. What had happened during the ambush is right before the soldiers were attacked, an Iraqi police vehicle passed the front of the convoy, flipped on its lights, and there was another one behind the convoy that flipped on its lights, and they peeled off, and the ambush began. And so with all the guys, they felt, you know, it was evident that there was some involvement with the Iraqi police. So after this, a large investigation.
Let's go to that clip.
Lieutenant Ahmed, what have you found out so far? Any idea who's doing it yet?
No.
Wow. Been investigating for 3 days and don't know anything? He sucks. Man, how much time you need? I think their first priority ought to be how to investigate. They don't go ask people questions. This is the third time since we've been here this has happened.
You don't want to know what I think.
I'm going in. In the room right now are the Iraqi police from Rashidiya. They're the ones who are actually handling the investigation. I mean, they have done basically nothing. Haven't gone out and talked to anybody, haven't done anything, so that's what he's talking to them about right now.
He's saying that whenever you guys were under attack, that they were at the end of the road, stopped. This guy says they were driving around up and down on the highway.
Basically, he claims not to know anything.
These guys know who did it. You know, they want to act like they don't know. Well, that's fine. I'm not going to trust any of them. Not any of them.
I don't believe them. I think they're involved. The only way we'll get to the bottom is if, when they ambush us again, we kill them. And we can take their dead, stinking carcasses up there and say, here you go. You said it wasn't your guys, and here it is. That's it. They've tried killing me, you know, my guys, my friends. You know, we've all been affected by these knuckleheads, and I'm sick of them. You know, the only way they're going to stop is to kill them. And all I need to do is just give me half an opportunity, and I'll do it.
Excerpt of the installment Off to War that will air on Saturday night, Discovery Times. The Renault brothers, Craig and Brent Renault, are Arkansas filmmakers who've been embedded with the Arkansas National Guard through their entire tour in Iraq.
That's an amazing clip, something that most Americans here are not getting a sense of, the enormous tension and animosity that's existing between U.S. troops and the Iraqis that they're supposedly training to take over.
Right. These aren't the so-called insurgents.
How widespread did you find that to be?
Well, it's unclear how widespread it is, because it's actually, they have trouble identifying who the enemy is at all. To them, everyone looks the same. They sound the same. No one's wearing a uniform. You know, it really is a guerrilla insurgency, and a lot of the insurgency is within the Iraqi National Guard and within the Iraqi police service. It's not clear how many, but certainly in this case, there was some involvement.
You also followed the soldiers when they returned, and we're going to take a look at a clip of some of the soldiers going back to the high school, talking to their neighbors and students about the war itself. What was the experiences that you noted in terms of their reintegrating back into American society after their experience in Iraq?
Yeah, well, these guys, this is a very patriotic town. These guys are heroes in their community. And when they came back, they were asked to speak at the schools. They were asked to come out events. There were parades for them. They were really embraced when they came back home. I think in the clip that we're going to see, some of the young guys go back to the high school where they just graduated 1 year prior to this, right before they went to Iraq. They graduated from this high school. So they go back to speak in, I think it's their civics class.
Let's go to the clip.
We're fortunate today to have Matt Hertline and Tommy Ert. Most of you probably already know these fellas, and most of us know where they've been for the last few months. If you have any questions you'd like to ask them, they'd be glad to answer them.
As long as you don't ask about political stuff, you know, keep away from that topic, whether or not we agree with being there. Have any of you guys ever thought about joining the military?
I wanted to be a Navy.
Just let them know what you want to do. No, don't let them just say, okay, you're going to be an infantryman, and you leave tomorrow to go to basic training. Don't let them do that, because they'll try to do it.
What exactly is a mortar?
The methods that they use to fight the Americans is very guerrilla-like. You know, they'll be 3 or 4 miles away, and they'll shoot mortars at us, or rockets. If one of their rockets blows up one of our guys, they've done their job.
Do people over there, like, treat y'all like their friends or whatever, or are they mean to you?
I think their whole goal in life is just to kill as many Americans as they can, you know. We know a lot of kids that are about you guys' age, and all they want to do is, like, go outside and play soccer, but they're afraid to because a rocket might hit them. You know what I mean? Could you imagine living like that? And people make houses out of the garbage. You guys got it awesome, great. And that is one of the first things I said whenever we got there. I do not ever want to hear an American complain about the conditions of living, ever, because it makes me sick. Just the ability to walk into Walmart. Man, I tell you what, yesterday afternoon, I went into Walmart. You just want to lay down and roll around on the floor. It's good stuff.
Seeing him smile again is like seeing the whole world brought up. It's amazing.
You're crying again, see?
This is my little brother, Adam.
Tell them about his little accident.
I don't know if any of you guys know this or not, but Mr. Earp here has actually, in fact, been wounded in Iraq.
This one still got metal in it. And the one in the armpit, we pulled the metal out. That really hurt worse than when it went in.
Our medic had blood from his right here all the way. He was just covered in blood. And I've known several people that were wounded, and I've known three or four people that were actually killed. And I don't know, it's just, it's war. And that's something I hope you guys never see. I really do.
The Arkansas National Guardsmen wouldn't talk about politics with the students in the high school, but they did talk about it with each other.
Just from like a boots on the ground point of view, I think we should kill all of them we can.
They're crazy.
Dude.
I don't think we should be able to begin with. It's George's daddy's war.
Do you think the whole reason they went into war is worth it?
I don't. Man, I think the reason that they went over there in the first place is because George Bush had himself and his administration convinced that there's all these f***ing weapons of mass destruction over there. We've been over there for 2 years, man, and we haven't turned up s***. Nothing.
You know, if they can find Saddam in a rat hole, why can't they find the Scud missile?
Exactly.
Why? He was his.
Because there's not any.
Right.
And right now, man, the people that are over there that are dying, I mean, sure, I'm not, you know, they're patriots and they're dying for their country and everything, but I think they're dying for the wrong cause.
I'm not over there, and no, I'm not going to be over there.
I don't like the reason that we're over there, but I think as long as we're there, we should just kill as many of those f***ing terrorists as we get a chance to kill.
But honestly, who's the terrorist and who's the civilian? You can't tell me you can stand a terrorist and a civilian side by side and tell the difference.
So to me, every civilian in Iraq is a terrorist, potentially.
Right. Potentially. But in that respect, you have to go over to Iran and you have to go over to Jerusalem and everywhere.
Every civilian in the Middle East is potentially a terrorist.
I'm saying it's not necessarily just the Middle East. It can be a little bit of everywhere.
I agree.
It's still good.
F*** them. Everybody that looks like them.
Arkansas National Guardsmen in the 6th chapter of Off to War, which is airing this weekend on Discovery Times. Off to War from rural Arkansas to Baghdad. I want to thank you both for being with us and for doing this absolutely remarkable series. Craig and Brent Renaud of DCTV, Downtown Community Television, our colleagues here at the Firehouse in New York. And that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdel-Kadous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Jeremy Scahill, Aaron Matei. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Go to our website for transcripts of the broadcast. We're podcasting there. You can see the video and the audio clips. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website, democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, and we